The stench of rendered protein and industrial lubricants had long since become my natural perfume, seeping into every pore until distinguishing where the factory ended and my flesh began proved impossible. From my throne atop the primary processing platform, I surveyed the domain that bore my mark, literally carved into the flesh of every soul who dared breathe within these corroded walls. The Crimson Talons ruled Quintanus Sector through methods that would make the ancient lords of Nostromo nod in grim approval, though those legendary monsters had taken their secrets to the grave when their world cracked apart like a rotten egg. My fingers traced the fresh scars along my forearms, each one a trophy from the latest challenger who thought himself worthy of my position. The ritual scarification served dual purposes, marking territory on my own body while demonstrating to my subordinates that pain was merely another currency in our economy of suffering. Three parallel gouges ran from elbow to wrist, still weeping crimson droplets that I allowed to fall onto the metal grating below. The sound of blood hitting steel created a rhythmic percussion that harmonized with the grinding machinery that never ceased its hungry consumption. The Flensing Throne demanded regular feeding, and today's offering writhed in the restraints I had personally welded to the chair's armrests. Kind Vorthak had controlled the Eastern protein vats for 2 years, skimming profits and thinking his distance from my seat of power granted him immunity. The strips of skin I had already peeled from his chest created a grotesque pattern of exposed muscle and fat, each removal performed with surgical precision to maximize both pain and duration. His muffled screams filtered through the gag I had fashioned from his own lieutenant's tongue, removed earlier as an appetizer to the main course. The throne itself represented my greatest achievement in applied terror, a masterwork of intimidation crafted from the skeletal remains of previous occupants and reinforced with industrial scrap metal salvaged from the factory's defunct sections. Vertebrae formed the backrest's curve, while femurs and tibias created armrests that still bore teeth marks from desperate victims who had tried to bite through bone rather than endure another session. The seat cushion consisted of tanned human hide stretched over a framework of ribs, creating a surface that molded perfectly to each new occupant's form while slowly pressing sharpened bone fragments through the leather to pierce their flesh. Vorthak's rebellion had begun 3 weeks prior when he stopped delivering his tribute of severed fingers, a currency I had established to ensure complete submission from every gang member. Each digit represented a life taken in my name, and the reduction in weekly collections suggested either weakness or treachery. Investigation revealed both, along with evidence that he had been recruiting followers with promises of overthrowing my rule and establishing a more egalitarian distribution of territory. The concept of equality within the Crimson Talons struck me as particularly amusing, given that our entire hierarchy depended on the strong literally carving their advancement from the flesh of the weak. The industrial sector of Quintanus stretched across 17 levels of the Underhive, each one more corrupted than the last as chemical runoff from the upper manufactorums seeped through cracked ceramite and corroded support beams. My domain occupied the deepest accessible level, where the protein processing facility had once converted organic waste into nutritional paste for the hive's lower classes. The machinery remained functional despite decades of neglect, its massive grinders and conveyor systems providing both practical utility and psychological warfare tools. The constant mechanical noise created an audio landscape of grinding metal and hydraulic pressure that masked screams, while the rhythmic pounding of industrial hammers provided a soundtrack for our daily rituals of violence. Blood had stained every surface of the factory floor, creating abstract patterns that told the story of my rise to power through a visual chronicle of spilled vitty. The main processing floor bore the deepest crimson patches where I had conducted mass executions during the early days of my rule, establishing dominance through systematic elimination of potential rivals. Conveyor belts still carried traces of the last batch of traitors I had fed through the grinders, their remains mixed with industrial lubricants to create a paste that now coated the machinery's moving parts. The smell of decomposition blended with chemical preservatives and machine oil to produce an atmosphere so toxic that newcomers often vomited within minutes of entering my domain. My lieutenants had learned to navigate this environment through gradual exposure and deliberate scarification of their respiratory systems. Each member of my inner circle bore ritual cuts along their throats and chest cavities, wounds that I had personally inflicted to ensure their breathing apparatus could filter the corrosive atmosphere while simultaneously marking them as my property. The scarification process involved precise incisions that severed specific nerve clusters, reducing their capacity for independent thought while enhancing their tolerance for pain. This modification created soldiers who could function in environments that would incapacitate unaltered humans while ensuring their absolute loyalty through neurological dependence on regular pain stimulation. The hierarchy of the Crimson Talons operated on principles that would have impressed the criminal organizations of ancient Nostromo, where advancement required literal consumption of one's predecessor's authority. My system demanded that aspiring leaders carve specific portions of flesh from their targets, consuming the raw meat in public ceremonies that demonstrated both their commitment to our cause and their willingness to embrace the fundamental savagery that defined our existence. The ritual consumption served multiple purposes, eliminating potential rivals, providing protein in an environment where food remained scarce, and creating psychological bonds between predator and prey that transcended normal human relationships. Fresh meat hung from hooks throughout the facility, some of it harvested from enemies, while other portions came from gang members who had failed to meet quotas or demonstrated insufficient enthusiasm for our methods. The distinction between punishment and sustenance had blurred beyond recognition, creating a culture where cannibalism represented both necessity and ceremony. I had established specific protocols for the preparation and distribution of human flesh, ensuring that every member understood their position in the food chain while maintaining quality control over our protein sources. The chemical runoff that seeped through the Underhive's infrastructure had transformed the local environment into a landscape of perpetual corrosion and mutation. The acidic compounds dissolved organic matter on contact, requiring constant vigilance to avoid areas where the concentration reached lethal levels. My skin bore permanent scarring from exposure to these chemicals, creating patterns of discoloration and texture that marked me as a survivor of the deepest levels. The corrosive atmosphere had also affected my respiratory system, producing a distinctive rasp that my subordinates had learned to interpret as either approval or imminent violence, depending on the specific pitch and duration. Kine's flesh continued to peel away in ribbons as I applied pressure to the flensing blade, each strip revealing new layers of fat and muscle beneath. His body had begun to shut down from blood loss and shock, but I had calculated the precise amount of tissue I could remove while maintaining consciousness. The art of extended torture required intimate knowledge of human anatomy combined with practical experience in the limits of pain tolerance. Years of practice had taught me to read the subtle signs that indicated approaching unconsciousness or death, allowing me to modulate my techniques to achieve maximum suffering within sustainable parameters. The other gang members watched from the processing floor below, their faces illuminated by the hellish glow of the furnaces that consumed our waste products. Each witness understood that their continued existence depended on my satisfaction with their performance, and that any sign of weakness or disloyalty would result in their own appointment with the Flensing throne. The psychological impact of public torture sessions extended far beyond the immediate victim, creating an atmosphere of constant fear that permeated every aspect of gang operations. My domain extended through a network of tunnels and chambers that had been carved from the Underhive's infrastructure through decades of expansion and conquest. Each new territory acquired through violence became integrated into our operational matrix, with specific areas designated for different aspects of our criminal enterprise. Torture chambers occupied the deepest levels where screams could not escape, while storage areas for harvested flesh required climate control to prevent spoilage. The protein processing equipment served multiple functions, converting enemies into food while disposing of evidence and maintaining the industrial facade that concealed our true activities from any authorities foolish enough to investigate. The perpetual darkness of the underhive had become my natural environment, with only the glow of furnaces and chemical reactions providing illumination. My eyes had adapted to these conditions through deliberate exposure to specific wavelengths of light that enhanced night vision while reducing sensitivity to bright illumination. This adaptation provided tactical advantages during raids on upper levels while ensuring that I remained comfortable in the depths where normal humans could barely function. The darkness also concealed the full extent of the scarification and mutation that marked my body, creating an aura of mystery that enhanced my psychological dominance over subordinates. Vorthak's rebellion had attracted 17 followers, each of whom now decorated the facility's exterior walls in various states of dismemberment. The public display served as both warning and advertisement, demonstrating the consequences of challenging my authority while showcasing the creative applications of industrial equipment in the art of execution. Bodies hung from chains attached to support beams, some still twitching as their nervous systems slowly shut down, while others had been reduced to skeletal frameworks that rattled in the artificial wind created by the ventilation systems. The systematic nature of these executions reflected principles I had absorbed from studying the legendary methods of Nostromo's criminal elite, though my techniques incorporated industrial efficiency with traditional cruelty. Each victim had been processed through specific stages of torture designed to extract maximum information while providing entertainment for my followers. The interrogation phase involved surgical removal of non-essential body parts, followed by chemical treatment to prevent unconsciousness from blood loss. The execution phase utilized the factory's machinery to create deaths that lasted for hours while producing sounds that echoed throughout the sector as warnings to potential rivals. My control over Quintana's sector represented the culmination of years spent perfecting the balance between terror and efficiency that defined successful criminal leadership in the Underhive's unforgiving environment. The combination of ritualistic violence, industrial resources, and strategic positioning had created an empire built on fear and sustained by the systematic consumption of human flesh and suffering. The sweet stench of cooked flesh filled the communal feeding chamber as I watched my lieutenants tear into the evening's protein ration with their usual savage enthusiasm. The meat had been processed through the grinders earlier that day, mixed with synthetic nutrients and reformed into blocks that bore no resemblance to their original source. Kain Vorthak's remains, along with three of his closest supporters, now sustained the very gang members who had once questioned my methods. The irony provided considerable satisfaction as I observed their eager consumption of their former comrade's flesh. Corvin Thek sat at the far end of the feeding table, his scarred hands methodically cutting his portion into precise strips before consuming each piece with deliberate slowness. Something in his manner had changed over the past weeks, a subtle shift in posture and eye contact that triggered instincts honed through years of survival in Quintana's sector. Where once he had displayed the appropriate deference expected from a lieutenant, now his gaze lingered too long on my movements, and his responses to orders carried an almost imperceptible delay that suggested internal calculation rather than immediate compliance. The feeding chamber occupied a section of the factory floor that had been cleared of machinery and fitted with crude furniture salvaged from abandoned HAB units in the upper levels. Long tables constructed from metal sheeting supported by industrial piping provided seating for 30 gang members, though tonight only 23 remained after the recent purge of Vorthak's supporters. The walls bore fresh decorations in the form of flensed skin stretched on frames, creating macabre tapestries that depicted the fate awaiting those who challenged my authority. As I consumed my own portion of the processed meat, I noticed several gang members exchanging glances across the table, brief moments of eye contact that carried meaning beyond casual acknowledgement. The subtle communications network that existed within any criminal organization had begun operating in patterns that excluded me, a development that required immediate investigation and decisive response. Years of leadership had taught me to recognize the early signs of conspiracy, and the current atmosphere in the feeding chamber carried the unmistakable tension of brewing rebellion. Thex had been recruiting quietly, his efforts masked by routine operational discussions that provided cover for more seditious conversations. Intelligence gathered through my network of informants revealed that he had approached at least 7 gang members with promises of territorial expansion and access to the torture facilities for their personal use. The proposition appealed to the basest instincts of men who had been denied the opportunity to inflict suffering on their own terms, constrained by my monopoly on the tools and techniques of systematic brutality. The concept of sharing the flensing chambers represented a fundamental challenge to the hierarchy that maintained order within the Crimson Talons. My exclusive control over the instruments of torture ensured that all acts of violence served the greater purpose of maintaining discipline and extracting information from enemies. Allowing individual gang members to pursue their sadistic impulses without oversight would transform the organization from a disciplined criminal enterprise into a chaotic collection of competing predators, whose only common ground would be their shared appetite for inflicting pain. The processed protein blocks contained fragments of bone and cartilage that had survived the grinding process, creating texture variations that reminded consumers of the meat's origin. I had deliberately maintained these imperfections to ensure that every meal carried psychological weight, forcing gang members to confront the reality of their cannibalistic practices while simultaneously normalizing the consumption of human flesh. The grinding process had been calibrated to leave recognizable fragments of teeth and fingernails, creating constant reminders of the fate that awaited those who opposed my rule. Thex's recruitment efforts had focused on gang members who controlled specific sections of the territory, individuals whose cooperation would be essential for any successful coup attempt. The Eastern Protein Vats, recently vacated by Vorthak's demise, represented the most valuable prize in any territorial redistribution scheme. The Western Storage Chambers, where we maintained our reserves of processed flesh and industrial chemicals, provided another significant asset that would appeal to ambitious subordinates seeking to establish their own power base. The feeding ritual served multiple purposes beyond simple sustenance, creating social bonds through shared participation in taboo acts while reinforcing the gang's separation from normal human society. The communal consumption of human flesh marked every participant as complicit in crimes that would result in immediate execution if discovered by imperial authorities, ensuring that loyalty remained absolute through mutual dependence on secrecy. The psychological impact of cannibalism extended beyond mere criminality, transforming gang members into predators whose humanity had been systematically eroded through repeated exposure to acts that violated fundamental social prohibitions. My quarters in the deepest section of the facility had begun showing signs of intrusion over the past week, subtle indicators that someone had been conducting surveillance while I attended to business elsewhere in the complex. Personal items had been moved fractional distances from their original positions, and the dust patterns on surfaces showed evidence of careful examination. The intruder possessed sufficient skill to avoid obvious detection while gathering intelligence about my daily routines and security arrangements. The discovery of skinned rats in my sleeping area marked an escalation in the psychological warfare being conducted against my leadership. The creatures had been flensed with surgical precision, their hides removed in single pieces that demonstrated considerable expertise with bladed instruments. The positioning of the carcasses followed no random pattern, instead forming geometric arrangements that suggested ritualistic significance. Each rat had been drained of blood before placement, preventing the usual staining that would have provided evidence of the timeline for their placement. My weapons cache showed evidence of tampering, with tally marks scratched into the handles of knives and the stocks of firearms. The marks appeared to have been made with industrial cutting tools, creating uniform grooves that would require considerable time and patience to complete. The number of marks varied between weapons, suggesting some form of scoring system that corresponded to future plans for their use. The psychological impact of discovering these modifications created a constant reminder that my most trusted tools had been violated by unknown hands. Whispered conversations in the corridors had begun incorporating phrases that carried obvious significance despite their deliberately cryptic nature. References to coronation ceremonies and the selection of new leadership filtered through the facility's communication networks, always spoken just loudly enough to ensure that fragments reached my ears while maintaining plausible deniability for the speakers. The timing of these conversations coincided with my movements through the complex, suggesting coordination between multiple conspirators who were tracking my location and schedule. The tradition of the Crimson Tithe had evolved from practical necessity into elaborate ritual over the years of my leadership, serving as both demonstration of personal strength and entertainment for gang members who craved increasingly extreme displays of violence. The ceremony required the gang leader to endure specific forms of torture while maintaining consciousness and demonstrating continued capacity for command. The escalating nature of each tithe ensured that leadership remained in the hands of individuals capable of surviving experiences that would destroy weaker personalities. Previous tithe ceremonies had involved exposure to industrial chemicals that burned away layers of skin while testing pain tolerance and mental resilience. The ritual scarification that marked my arms and torso represented accumulated evidence of successful completion of these ordeals, each scar corresponding to a specific challenge that had been overcome through sheer force of will. The psychological impact on gang members who witnessed these ceremonies created an aura of invincibility around my leadership while establishing benchmarks for the level of suffering required to maintain authority. Thex had begun making subtle suggestions about the timing and nature of the next tithe ceremony, proposing modifications to traditional procedures that would increase the risk of permanent injury or death. His recommendations focused on extending the duration of exposure to corrosive substances while reducing the recovery time between different phases of the ordeal. The proposed changes appeared to emerge from genuine concern for maintaining the ceremony's effectiveness as a leadership test, but careful analysis revealed that the modifications would significantly increase the probability of fatal outcomes. The manipulation of tithe procedures represented a sophisticated approach to assassination that would eliminate me while maintaining the appearance of adherence to established traditions. The gang's investment in the ceremony as a legitimizing ritual meant that my death during a properly conducted tithe would be accepted as evidence of natural succession rather than murder. Thex's position as senior lieutenant would make him the logical candidate to assume leadership following my demise, providing both motive and opportunity for the proposed modifications. The feeding chamber's atmosphere had grown increasingly tense as the meal progressed, with conversations becoming more subdued and eye contact more carefully managed. The usual boisterous discussions of recent raids and territorial acquisitions had been replaced by cautious exchanges that avoided topics related to leadership or future planning. The change in social dynamics reflected the underlying tension created by the conspiracy's development, as participants struggled to maintain normal appearances while coordinating their seditious activities. Industrial lubricants mixed with the processed meat created a distinctive flavor profile that had become associated with successful operations and territorial expansion. The chemical contamination of our food supply represented another aspect of life in the Underhive's deepest levels, where exposure to toxic substances remained unavoidable despite careful filtration efforts. The long-term health effects of consuming contaminated protein had become evident in the physical deterioration visible among veteran gang members, whose bodies bore the accumulated damage of years spent in this corrosive environment. The grinding machinery that processed our protein sources required regular maintenance to prevent mechanical failures that would disrupt food production and waste valuable organic material. The complex system of conveyor belts, cutting implements, and compression chambers demanded expertise that only a few gang members possessed, creating strategic vulnerabilities that could be exploited by enemies seeking to disrupt our operations. The technical knowledge required to maintain and operate this equipment represented another form of power within the organization, as control over food production translated directly into influence over gang loyalty and survival. My observation of the feeding ritual revealed subtle changes in behavior patterns that confirmed the existence of a coordinated conspiracy against my leadership. The careful positioning of conspirators around the table, the timing of their consumption, and the pattern of their conversations all indicated a level of organization that extended beyond casual dissatisfaction with current leadership. The conspiracy had reached a stage where active coordination was occurring, suggesting that the timeline for action had been established and implementation was imminent. The paranoia had begun gnawing at my thoughts like acid through metal, each passing hour bringing fresh evidence of the conspiracy that festered within my own ranks. Sleep became impossible as I found myself cataloging every glance, every whispered conversation, every subtle shift in behavior that might signal the approaching betrayal. The feeding chamber's artificial calm the previous evening had confirmed my worst suspicions about Thex's recruitment efforts, and now the need for decisive action burned through my consciousness like molten slag through flesh. The torture chambers beneath the main facility provided the perfect venue for extracting confessions from suspected conspirators. I selected three gang members whose loyalty had seemed questionable during recent operations, dragging them from their sleeping quarters in the pre-dawn hours when resistance would be minimal and witnesses scarce. The industrial chains that secured them to the interrogation frames had been heated in the furnaces until the metal glowed cherry red, ensuring that even the initial restraint process would begin breaking down their psychological defenses. Merk Volus, who controlled access to the eastern storage vaults, provided the first target for my investigation. His screams echoed through the chamber as I applied pressure to specific nerve clusters along his spine, techniques learned through years of experimentation on previous subjects. The flensing blade peeled away strips of skin from his shoulders and chest, while I demanded details about conversations he might have had with Thex regarding territorial redistribution or changes in leadership structure. The information extracted through systematic torture revealed the disturbing scope of the conspiracy against my rule. Volus admitted to participating in discussions about dividing my territory among multiple lieutenants, with each conspirator receiving control over specific sections of the protein processing operation. The proposed redistribution would eliminate the centralized authority structure that had maintained order within the Crimson Talons, replacing it with a loose confederation of competing interests that would inevitably collapse into internal warfare. The second prisoner, Grix Hammerfist, controlled the maintenance schedules for the grinding machinery and possessed intimate knowledge of the facility's operational vulnerabilities. His interrogation revealed plans to sabotage critical equipment during the next major processing cycle, creating chaos that would provide cover for the assassination attempt on my person. The conspiracy had evolved beyond simple leadership change into a comprehensive plan for seizing control of all gang assets and eliminating potential opposition through coordinated violence. The third captive, Jorik Skinflayer, had been responsible for training new recruits in the proper techniques for harvesting flesh from living subjects. His confession detailed Thex's promises to expand access to torture facilities, allowing individual gang members to pursue their sadistic impulses without oversight or restriction. The prospect of unlimited access to victims and torture implements had proven irresistible to men whose appetites for inflicting pain had been constrained by my monopoly on the instruments of suffering. Each revelation extracted through torture provided additional evidence of Thex's careful planning and recruitment strategy. The conspiracy had been designed to appeal to the specific desires and grievances of different gang members, offering territorial control to those who craved power, access to torture facilities for those who desired to inflict pain, and promises of increased profit sharing for those motivated primarily by material gain. The comprehensive nature of these appeals demonstrated sophisticated understanding of human psychology and organizational dynamics. The systematic torture of suspected conspirators served multiple purposes beyond intelligence gathering, sending clear messages to other gang members about the consequences of disloyalty while providing opportunities to test new techniques for extracting information from unwilling subjects. The industrial setting of the interrogation chambers allowed for the incorporation of factory equipment into the torture process, using conveyor belts to transport victims between different stations, while heated metal components provided additional sources of pain and intimidation. The discovery that 17 gang members had been recruited into the conspiracy required immediate response to prevent the planned coup from reaching fruition. However, my aggressive interrogation methods had begun producing unintended consequences, as the surviving gang members witnessed the systematic torture of their comrades and began questioning whether Thex's claims about my instability and paranoia might contain elements of truth. The very actions I took to root out the conspiracy provided validation for the conspirators' arguments about my unfitness for continued leadership. The protein processing facility's night shift provided the perfect opportunity for the conspirators to implement their plan, as the skeleton crew and reduced lighting created ideal conditions for an ambush. I had been conducting routine inspections of the grinding equipment when the attack commenced, industrial chains swinging from the shadows to strike my head and shoulders with devastating force. The metallic links had been weighted with fragments of scrap metal, transforming them into devastating weapons that could crush bone and tear flesh with each impact. Consciousness fled as the chains wrapped around my throat and limbs, cutting off blood flow to my brain while the conspirators worked together to restrain my struggling form. The coordinated nature of the attack revealed extensive planning and rehearsal, with each participant knowing exactly when and where to strike for maximum effectiveness. The use of industrial equipment as weapons demonstrated practical thinking that incorporated the facility's resources into their assault strategy. Awakening brought the horrifying realization that I had been secured to my own flensing throne, the restraints welded shut with industrial torches to prevent any possibility of escape. The irony of my situation provided considerable amusement to the assembled conspirators, who had gathered around the throne to observe my predicament and debate the specific procedures they would employ during my systematic torture. The reversal of roles from torturer to victim created a psychological impact that extended beyond mere physical helplessness. The gang members who had once cowered before my authority now displayed eager anticipation as they examined the various torture implements arranged on nearby tables. Flensing blades of different sizes and configurations provided options for removing skin in strips of varying width and thickness, while heated metal rods offered opportunities to cauterize wounds and prevent unconsciousness from blood loss. The careful preparation of torture instruments revealed that considerable thought had been devoted to maximizing both the duration and intensity of my suffering. Thex stood at the center of the group, directing the selection of initial procedures while explaining his vision for the systematic dismantling of my authority through prolonged torture. His plans involved removing specific portions of my anatomy in a predetermined sequence, with each amputation accompanied by detailed explanations of how my former territory and possessions would be redistributed among the conspirators. The psychological torture of describing my empire's dissolution while physically dismantling my body represented a sophisticated approach to revenge that combined practical and emotional elements. The first strips of skin came away from my chest and shoulders with surgical precision, the conspirators taking turns with the flensing blades to ensure that each participant had opportunities to inflict direct damage on my person. The removal process had been designed to avoid major blood vessels and organs, prolonging consciousness while maximizing pain through exposure of nerve endings to the corrosive atmosphere of the facility. The systematic nature of the flensing revealed that considerable research had been conducted into human anatomy and pain tolerance. The processed protein that had sustained the gang for months now served as the medium for a grotesque form of forced cannibalism, as strips of my own flesh were fed through the grinders and mixed with synthetic nutrients before being forced down my throat. The irony of consuming my own body while remaining conscious created a psychological horror that transcended physical pain, transforming the feeding process into an act of symbolic self-destruction that mirrored the collapse of my criminal empire. Each gang member carved their initials into the exposed muscle tissue of my arms and torso, creating permanent records of their participation in my downfall while simultaneously marking their territory on my body. The carving process required considerable time and precision to ensure that the letters remained legible despite the trauma inflicted on surrounding tissue. The ritualistic nature of this marking ceremony transformed my torture into a form of perverted coronation for the new leadership structure. Thex's announcement that my suffering would continue indefinitely provided the final revelation of his ultimate intentions for my fate. Rather than executing me quickly to eliminate potential threats to his new regime, he planned to maintain my existence as a source of entertainment and an object lesson for future gang meetings. The prospect of endless torture sessions conducted for the amusement of my former subordinates represented a fate worse than death, transforming me from feared leader into living demonstration of the consequences of failed leadership. The systematic division of my territory proceeded according to plans that had been developed during weeks of secret negotiations between the conspirators. Each participant received specific assets and operational responsibilities that reflected their contributions to the successful coup, while ensuring that no single individual could accumulate sufficient power to challenge the new collective leadership structure. The careful balance of territorial assignments revealed sophisticated understanding of organizational dynamics and power distribution. The protein processing facility would continue operating under the new management structure, with different gang members controlling various aspects of the operation from raw material acquisition to final product distribution. The torture chambers would be open to general use by gang members seeking to pursue their sadistic impulses, though scheduling conflicts would be resolved through a rotation system that ensured equitable access to victims and equipment. My former quarters had already been ransacked and divided among the conspirators, with personal possessions distributed according to a predetermined hierarchy that reflected each participant's status within the new organization. The weapons cache provided arms for enforcing the new territorial boundaries, while my collection of torture implements would be shared among gang members who demonstrated sufficient skill in their application. The transformation of the Crimson Talons from centralized dictatorship to collective leadership represented a fundamental shift in organizational philosophy that would have significant implications for future operations and territorial expansion. The elimination of my monopoly on violence and torture would likely result in increased internal conflicts as individual gang members pursued personal vendettas without oversight or restraint. The flensing process continued through the night as each conspirator took multiple turns removing portions of my flesh while describing their plans for utilizing their newly acquired territory and resources. The systematic nature of the torture ensured that consciousness remained intact despite the accumulating trauma, allowing me to witness the complete dissolution of the empire I had built through years of careful violence and strategic brutality. The meat hooks had been driven through my shoulders with deliberate care, positioned to support my weight while avoiding major arteries that would cause rapid blood loss. The industrial chains that suspended me from the processing chamber's ceiling creaked with each labored breath, creating a rhythmic percussion that blended with the facility's never-ending mechanical symphony. Below me, the Crimson Talons conducted their daily business with casual indifference to my suffering, using my ragged gasps as ambient noise for their territorial negotiations. Thex moved between the various gang members with newfound authority, his scarred hands gesturing toward different sections of the facility while explaining the new distribution of assets and responsibilities. The Eastern Protein Vats would fall under Grix Hammerfist's control, while Jorik Skinflayer assumed command of the torture chambers that had once been my exclusive domain. Each assignment was met with eager nods and calculating glances as the conspirators mentally catalogued their newly acquired territories. The hooks had been positioned with surgical precision to maximize both pain and duration, piercing through muscle and cartilage while avoiding the major blood vessels that would have granted me the mercy of rapid exsanguination. The weight of my suspended body created constant tension on the wounds, tearing the flesh wider with each involuntary movement, while gravity pulled streams of blood down my torso to pool on the factory floor below. The metallic taste of my own vitty filled my mouth as internal injuries from the initial beating continued bleeding into my throat and lungs. My former lieutenants had gathered around a makeshift table constructed from metal sheeting, spreading crude maps of Quintanis Sector across its surface while discussing expansion plans and territorial boundaries. The casual nature of their planning session, conducted mere meters from my suspended form, demonstrated their complete dismissal of any threat I might still represent. Occasionally, one of them would glance upward to observe my condition, checking to ensure that consciousness remained intact for the entertainment value of my prolonged suffering. The flensing process had left my torso resembling raw meat displayed in a butcher's shop, with strips of skin hanging in ribbons from my chest and shoulders. The exposed muscle tissue glistened with blood and lymphatic fluid, while nerve endings fired random signals that created waves of agony radiating through my suspended form. The systematic removal of my flesh had been conducted with expertise gained from years of torturing others, each cut calculated to maximize pain while preventing unconsciousness or death. Thex approached my suspended form with a curved blade that had been heated in one of the furnaces until the metal glowed orange with accumulated heat. The searing touch of the heated steel against my exposed flesh created new dimensions of agony, while simultaneously cauterizing wounds to prevent blood loss that might interfere with the extended torture session. The smell of burning meat filled the air around my suspended body, adding another layer of horror to the already overwhelming sensory assault. The processing chamber's machinery continued its relentless operation throughout my ordeal, grinding organic matter into protein paste, while hydraulic systems compressed waste products into manageable blocks. The industrial symphony provided a soundtrack for my torture that seemed deliberately designed to mask screams while creating an atmosphere of mechanical indifference to human suffering. The constant noise prevented any possibility of calling for assistance, though no help existed within the facility's corrupted depths. Gang members took turns approaching my suspended form to inflict additional wounds or simply observe the results of their collective handiwork. Some carved their initials deeper into the exposed muscle tissue of my arms and legs, while others experimented with different torture techniques they had observed during my own interrogation sessions. The participatory nature of my torture served to bind the conspirators together through shared complicity in acts that would have horrified normal humans. The redistribution of my personal possessions proceeded with methodical efficiency as gang members claimed weapons, torture implements, and other valuable items from my former quarters. The collection of flensing blades that had served as symbols of my authority now passed into the hands of subordinates who handled them with reverent fascination. Each implement carried memories of the victims who had suffered under its edge, transforming the weapons into relics of the terror I had once wielded with absolute authority. Thex returned to my suspended form carrying a bowl that contained my still beating heart, removed with surgical precision while I remained conscious to witness its extraction. The organ continued pumping despite its separation from my circulatory system, creating a grotesque display of biological persistence that fascinated the assembled gang members. The rhythmic contractions gradually weakened as oxygen deprivation began shutting down the cardiac muscle, though the beating continued for several minutes after removal. The consumption of my heart marked the beginning of Thex's ascension ceremony, with each bite of the raw organ representing his absorption of the authority and power I had accumulated during years of leadership. The other conspirators watched with hungry anticipation as he chewed the tough cardiac muscle, blood streaming down his chin while he savored both the taste and the symbolic significance of consuming his predecessor's life force. The cannibalistic ritual transformed my murder into a form of perverted communion that bound the new leadership structure together through shared participation in taboo acts. Portions of my organs were distributed among the gang members according to a predetermined hierarchy that reflected their contributions to the successful coup. Liver segments went to those who had provided crucial intelligence about my routines and security arrangements, while kidney portions rewarded those who had recruited additional conspirators or provided material support for the assassination attempt. The systematic distribution of my internal organs created a grotesque parody of religious communion that elevated cannibalism to the level of sacred ritual. My consciousness began fragmenting as blood loss and trauma overwhelmed my nervous system's capacity to process sensory input. The sounds of the processing chamber became distorted and distant, while visual perception narrowed to a tunnel that excluded peripheral details. The sensation of my body suspended from the meat hooks grew increasingly abstract, as if the physical form belonged to someone else, while my awareness floated somewhere above the scene of my torture. The gang members had begun preparing my skin for the construction of Thex's new throne, stretching the flensed hide across a metal framework salvaged from the facility's defunct machinery. The process required careful treatment with industrial chemicals to prevent decomposition while maintaining the leather's flexibility for upholstery purposes. The sight of my own flesh being transformed into furniture created a final indignity that transcended the physical agony of my torture. My bones were systematically harvested and fed into grinding equipment that reduced them to powder suitable for mixing with ceremonial war paint. The calcium-rich dust would be combined with blood and industrial pigments to create markings that identified gang members as participants in my assassination and consumption. The transformation of my skeletal remains into decorative materials ensured that traces of my physical form would continue serving the organization that had destroyed me. The construction of the new throne proceeded with ritualistic attention to detail, as gang members competed to contribute specific elements to the project. My vertebrae formed the backrest's curve, while my ribs created armrests that would remind future occupants of the fate awaiting failed leaders. The skull was mounted at the throne's apex, creating a grotesque crown that would oversee all future meetings and torture sessions conducted in the processing chamber. Thex settled into the completed throne with obvious satisfaction, testing the comfort of the seat cushion created from my tanned hide while examining the bone armrests that had once supported my own weight during countless torture sessions. The reversal of roles from victim to authority figure was complete, with my physical remains now serving as the foundation for his new regime. The psychological impact of sitting upon furniture constructed from his predecessor's body would reinforce his dominance over subordinates while providing constant reminders of the consequences of challenging his authority. The remaining portions of my flesh were processed through the facility's grinding equipment, mixed with synthetic nutrients, and formed into protein blocks that bore no resemblance to their human origin. The systematic conversion of my body into food represented the final stage of my transformation from gang leader to consumable resource. The irony of becoming sustenance for the organization I had created provided a grotesque form of immortality that would continue long after my consciousness finally faded. The protein paste created from my ground flesh was packaged into containers marked with the Crimson Talon symbol, preparing it for distribution to rival gangs as a message about the consequences of territorial encroachment. The psychological impact of consuming human remains, even unknowingly, would create subtle changes in the recipient's behavior while demonstrating the new leadership's commitment to maintaining the brutal traditions that had defined the organization under my rule. Basement levels beneath the processing facility were being converted into additional torture chambers to accommodate the increased demand for recreational violence among gang members who had been denied access to such facilities during my centralized rule. The expansion of torture capacity would allow individual gang members to pursue their sadistic impulses without scheduling conflicts while providing new sources of fresh meat for the protein processing operation. The construction of these new chambers incorporated lessons learned from observing my own methods, with improved restraint systems and more efficient drainage for blood and other bodily fluids. Industrial equipment salvaged from abandoned sections of the facility provided heating elements and cutting tools that would enhance the torture experience while reducing the labor required to maintain victims in suitable condition for extended suffering. Fresh victims were already being secured for the inaugural sessions in the new torture chambers, with gang members competing to claim the most promising subjects for their personal use. The democratization of torture represented a fundamental shift in the organization's culture, transforming systematic brutality from centralized authority tool into recreational activity available to all members in good standing. The cycle of violence that had defined Quintana's sector would continue under new management, with each generation of gang leaders rising through demonstrated capacity for inflicting suffering while consuming the flesh of their predecessors. The Underhive's darkness had claimed another soul while ensuring that the traditions of brutality and cannibalism would persist through endless iterations of predator and prey. My fading consciousness registered the sounds of new screams echoing from the basement levels as the expanded torture facilities claimed their first victims. The mechanical symphony of the processing equipment continued its relentless operation, grinding fresh meat while hydraulic systems compressed waste products into manageable blocks. The facility's appetite for human suffering remained as insatiable as ever, though the identity of those who fed its hunger had changed. The last sensation I experienced was the taste of my own blood filling my throat as internal injuries finally overwhelmed my body's capacity to sustain life. The meat hooks continued supporting my weight even as consciousness faded, ensuring that my corpse would remain suspended above the processing chamber as a permanent reminder of the price of failed leadership. The Crimson Talons had consumed their creator, but the hunger that drove them would never be satisfied.